This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Howie Hawkins, a possible Green Party presidential candidate, talks about one of his original ideas, the Green New Deal. The Black is Back Coalition explores the possibilities of electoral politics under late-stage imperial capitalism. And South Carolina activists pay respect to those killed in a prison disturbance.
But first, it's taken a while to count all of the votes, but it appears that community control of the police has made a giant leap forward in Chicago. Activists ran a full slate of candidates in support of CPAC, the proposed Civilian Police Accountability Commission. Frank Chapman is with the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. He says community control of the police is now backed by a substantial block of new members on the Chicago City Council.
We may pick up a few more when the dust clears, because they're still counting some people. But right now, we definitely have 17 CPAC candidates. And 8 of these 17 are Black, 7 are Latinx, 5 are women, 2 are LGBTQ, and 2 are white. And 5 of them are self-proclaimed socialists. You know, mostly we're talking about the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. So that's where our count stands right now. So most of the wards that went with CPAC were Black wards. Then after that, brown wards, Latino. And then only 2 white wards with CPAC. So this movement has matured and materialized like we've been saying all along. This is a Black-led movement because we are bearing the brunt of police crimes in this city. And therefore, the call for community control of the police arose in the Black community, going all the way back to the days of the Panther Party. This is an old battle cry in our community, a demand, an ancient demand, so to speak. So it's come to some fruition in Chicago in a remarkable way, because you got to look at it like this. Before these elections, we only had one solid champion of CPAC in that city council, and that was Carlos Rosa. We had no Black alder person that would stand up and fight for this bill, although we had about 3 or 4 of them who had signed on to the legislation. I say 3 or 4 because one of them, to this day, I don't understand why she put her name on the bill. But she lost in the election, too. So now, the thing that I'm saying is that we went from that to 17. That's dramatic. That's a qualitative change.
There's no question that's dramatic. And of course, no city in the country has what one could honestly call Black community control of the police. So this would seem, even at this stage, to put Chicago in the lead on this issue.
Or at least the epicenter. Yeah, I would say we're definitely in the lead on it. And it's historically been our destiny, because this is the city where Mark Clark and Fred Hampton were murdered, which is when this cry for community control of the police first came up, and when the Black Police Patrolmen's Union first came up in this city in response to that murder. So, I would agree with the way you characterize that 100%.
Now, these 17 people, they are united in that they've all endorsed CPAC, the Community Control of Police Bill, but politicians that would endorse community control of the police probably also share some other political characteristics.
Absolutely. Most of them, I would say, at this point, I would say all of them, also support community control of the Board of Education. So they support a progressive agenda around issues of housing, jobs, reparations, and that sort of thing.
So therefore, could we anticipate that this might be at least the core of a progressive bloc on the Board of Aldermen in Chicago?
This is going to be, mark my words, this is going to be the progressive bloc in the city of Chicago. Because the so-called progressive caucus that they have now is going to be completely eclipsed by this one, by these new people who are coming in.
Some of the people on that so-called progressive bloc that they have now, obviously you don't consider them to be progressives.
Hardly anybody that's progressive in Chicago does. Because they've been dancing to the tune of the Central Business District, and they've been going along with the gentrification. They're only progressive in name, in terms of policies and in terms of their political tactics in the council. They're definitely not progressive. These new people that are coming into the city council, a good number of them come out of the movement, and they're progressive.
In terms of the CPAC bill, what's the next step?
We're going to have a new signing of the bill on April the 30th, where we're going to call in all of our people who have been elected in the last election and have them all sign onto the bill. So we've now doubled, almost tripled the numbers of people who will be signers onto that bill. And then on Inauguration Day, which is May the 20th, we're going to have our own inauguration ceremony where we are going to make CPAC and other parts of the progressive agenda, the mandate for the new city council, the people's mandate.
You're part of the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Black Lives Matter was part of the coalition that pushed for these electoral changes. I guess you guys are patting each other on the back and thinking about new joint ventures to do.
Yeah, well, we don't want to break our hands on each other's backs. But you're definitely thinking about new joint ventures. What the Alliance is pushing for is this. In all 17 of those wards, we want to build up CPAC ward committees, or committees for community control and the police, so that we will have a grassroots-based organization in each ward that we have won to consolidate this victory. I believe in these young people that we've elected. I believe that they're going to adhere to a progressive agenda, but we need more than that. We need an organization to back up those beliefs. We believe that politicians will be politicians, and that there has to always be a mass movement present to make sure that our interests are not betrayed, that our interests are maintained and carried through. And so that's how we're going to move one forward, is to consolidate our victories by building bases in all of these wards. So we're talking about 17 wards.
The police and the business community, they can count too. They must be in a state of some anxiety about the emergence of this new progressive bloc.
I believe they are. And they're going to try to use the new mayor, Lori Lightfoot, and I don't mind saying it, they're going to try to use her to destroy our movement. And so we're going to have to stand fast. There's going to be a serious struggle here.
And what has Lightfoot's history been regarding the police and the community?
She's been with the police. That's where she's been. She was president of the police board for almost 5 years. And during that time, she fought us tooth and nail over the question of community control of the police. She is not for that. She has privately described us as the lunatic fringe because we're demanding our democratic right to say who police is our communities and how our communities are police. So we see her as our adversary, our principal adversary going forward.
Well, with 17 members on a 50-member board of aldermen, you're not a fringe anymore.
We're not a fringe anymore. And she's going to have to deal with that reality. Well, this whole city is going to have to deal with that reality. I'm not a prophet, but I would project that we're going to win a lot of more things. I believe that we're going to be going forward on this because now we have the mass base to do it with. It's not about trust. It's not about anything except power. And what we have done in this last election, we have changed the power relationships in this city in favor of our people. And so that's the nail we got to drive to the wall.
Now, again, all of these activist organizations jumped wholeheartedly into the electoral arena, specifically to pass CPAC. But that doesn't mean that you've become an electoral organization.
No, we're not an electoral organization. I don't think we should become one. I think we should do what we do, build a mass movement to move the politics in the direction that we feel it needs to be moved in. We're not pushing politicians. We're pushing issues. And I think we should continue to do that.
That was Frank Chapman of the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression in Chicago.
The Green New Deal, a plan to transform the way the nation uses energy, while at the same time ensuring adequate incomes for all and addressing the historical wrongs against minorities, has won the support of supermajorities of Democrats under the sponsorship of New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, commonly called AOC. But the Green New Deal originated in the Green Party more than a decade ago, and a key player in formulating the original Green New Deal was Howie Hawkins, its former candidate for governor of New York. Hawkins is now exploring a bid for the presidency under the Green Party banner. We asked Hawkins what's good about the Democratic Party's version of the Green New Deal.
Well, the good thing about the AOC Green New Deal is it links economic security and climate security. So it has in there the job guarantee and Medicare for all. And when I first campaigned for a Green New Deal for New York in 2010, I was running for governor as a Green Party candidate, and I was running against Andrew Cuomo, who had an austerity plan. We're coming out of the Great Recession. So I was talking about a Green New Deal that would fulfill the original promise of the New Deal as Franklin Roosevelt articulated it in a State of the Union address in 1944, calling on Congress to enact an economic bill of rights, the right to employment, an income above poverty, decent housing, comprehensive health care, and good public education. And we've never realized those things. So that was the public investment that we needed to get us out of that Great Recession. And then the green part of it was, we need big public investment in moving to 100% clean energy because we face this climate crisis. So that was the concept of the Green New Deal. And I think it continues in general outline with the AOC proposal and the Sunshine Movement, these young folks that sat in outside Pelosi's office and really brought it to the national stage. Now, they kind of dropped some things that we're talking about, like they're silent. Well, what happened was they wanted a select committee for a Green New Deal, and Pelosi sliced, diced, and put that down to disposal because first she said, okay, maybe you can have it, but you can't subpoena witnesses. And then she said, and you can't put legislation on the floor. You got to go through other committees. And then finally she said, we're not going to do it. So AOC came back with Senator Markey with a non-binding resolution for a Green New Deal, and Pelosi won't even put it on the floor. McConnell put it on the floor in the Senate, and the Democrats either voted against it or just present. So the problem for the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez people and people trying to get it into Congress is that the Democrats won't let it happen. That's why we need a Green Party out here calling for the Green New Deal and making sure that it gets addressed. And hopefully the Sunshine Movement and others will make the presidential candidates address it. And we will come out with a proposal for a Green New Deal that we hope sets the standard. We need to get to 100% clean energy by 2030. We need not just a job guarantee and Medicare for all, but we need a massive housing program so that the rent isn't too damn high. That means public housing and universal rent control. We need free public education from pre-K through as high as, you know, you want to go and your abilities take you in public colleges. And we need a income guarantee so that nobody's below the poverty line. And then when we come to the energy piece, we got to say not just we're going for 100% clean energy, but we got to stop right now building new fossil fuel infrastructure. And we've got to nationalize big oil. You know, Exxon and the Koch brothers are not going to reinvest their earnings from fossil fuels in renewables. They're going to reinvest it in more fossil fuels. So we need to take over the oil industry, public utilities so we can actually plan a transition and effectively execute it.
So you're saying that a Green New Deal dies on the vine in the Democratic Party, and so we need a Green New Deal that is nurtured by an independent Green Party.
Exactly. That's the reason we run, to put issues on a table that others ignore or dismiss, the other two parties.
But are you happy that there is a faction, small as it is, in the Democratic Party that is running with essentially the Green Party's plan?
I am, because they've made it an issue of national debate. And that's a platform we created, and we have every right to be on it, and we can be part of the discussion. So it's better to have a controversy about it than to not even have it discussed.
What's even more rare than Green New Dealers in the Democratic Party are people who advocate for peace, or at least for a scale back in U.S. aggressions.
Yeah, we actually need a global Green New Deal. Instead of being the world's military superpower, we should be the world's humanitarian superpower. That was Ralph Nader's slogan when he ran for president. We should be making friends instead of enemies. And we can do that by taking the peace dividend from deep cuts in military spending, I'm talking on the order of 50% to 75%, and investing a good portion of that in meeting basic needs around the world. The UN has a development budget to meet those basic needs. It's a fraction of what we spend on the military. And then we need to help countries leap over the fossil fuel age as they develop into the solar age. And that would do more to secure peace around the world than sending U.S. troops and having them stationed in over 800 military bases around the world.
There's a lot of talk, especially among Democrats, about the Trump administration heralding the dawn of a new fascism in the United States. I know, of course, that you oppose Trump and you oppose Democrats as well, but do you think that Trump is some kind of new and unique threat in U.S. history?
Well, we've had people like Trump for the whole history, even going back to the pre-colonial period, because he's a racist divider. He uses race, ethnicity, marginalized groups, scapegoats them, and he divides the people. And he does it in a more extreme form. I've heard some people say, well, Trump is good to be in there because it woke people up. You know, that's like saying we should put the Redeemers in power during Reconstruction to wake up people fighting for Reconstruction. I mean, that's crazy. You don't give power to the racists. So he's more extreme. But the problem with the Democrats is they aren't dealing with institutional racism. I mean, a lot of people sort of think that's disembodied. But the fact is racists are living, breathing racists. They are the gatekeepers. They're the employers. They're the real estate agents. They're the bankers, you know, they did all that predatory lending that ended up taking half of black wealth during the Great Recession. And so the Democrats have not really addressed that question. And they talk a lot about we got to deal with bad racist attitudes. Yes, we do. But more important is to take power from the racists. And the way to do that is to empower racially oppressed communities. And one of the things we want to do with the Green New Deal is make sure that as the different programs are implemented, they're under community control. Because when oppressed communities have control of their own housing, schools, businesses, police, they take the power out of the racists. The racists can't subject them to discrimination and exclusion. So that's where the Democrats come short. They talk about being against racism, but they aren't really undermining the institutional racism that gives the racists the power to oppress.
Occupy Wall Street was a political watershed in recent history, and those activists bequeathed us a very useful slogan, the 99% against the 1%, but they never went the full mile to say that the banks need to be nationalized. What would your banking policy be?
Well, the big banks should be nationalized for sure. And we can provide credit, particularly for the Green New Deal requires a lot of public investment, long-term investment. That's got to be financed. And when you do it with a public bank, the financing costs are less. We have the State Bank of North Dakota, which partners with community banks. These are local banks, not giant banks. They're totally outside the Federal Reserve System and not dependent on Wall Street. so they don't, Wall Street doesn't get its cut when they do financing in North Dakota. And this is so practical that those Republicans up there love their socialist bank. And that's what we've got to replicate around the country. And it should start with the big banks, which are too big to fail. I mean, Attorney General Holder told the U.S. Senate that he didn't really want to prosecute them for their crimes, including predatory lending, during the build-up to the Great Recession because he was afraid they were too big to fail and would cause systemic problems. So some of the Democrats say, let's break them up. I say, let's socialize the big banks. So I think that is crucial, and we need public banks in order to target investments to where they're needed in this new green economy with clean energy. And when we talk about a Green New Deal, we're not just talking about energy, because there's, you know, you can break the economy into about a dozen major production systems. And if they are not transformed towards sustainability, we won't even get to 100% clean energy. So that means manufacturing. It means agriculture. I mean, we face an existential threat from pesticides and soil depletion and aquifer depletion from industrialized agriculture. We've got to go to a regenerative organic agriculture because the insects are dying. And the scientists tell us in a couple of decades, insect populations will collapse, which means ecosystems collapse, food production collapses, and civilization collapses. I mean, we face that threat as well as the climate threat. So in order to have coordinated reconstruction of all the production systems, we need a democratic planning system for the nationalized industries and the banks to invest in this reconstruction of the economy.
Can a capitalist regime in the superpower ever come to grips with the climate crisis?
I don't think so. You've got the problem of the vested interests of the big oil companies, and they're just worried about the next quarter's profits and the price of their shares. So they are never going to address these problems. And you've got a system based on, it's a competitive structure where all the firms are trying to grow and expand. And that's incompatible with a sustainable economy ecologically. You know, that growth is like cancer is to a body. It just grows without any sense of balance or reciprocity with the ecosystems. So to get a sustainable society, if we don't replace capitalism with a democratic, socialist economic system, we're not going to get there to sustainability.
You're a co-founder of the Green Party. The party's been around a long time. People do know about it, but you failed to get to 5% of the vote in the last election. What's wrong with the Green Party?
Well, I think we have, after initially we started as a, you know, a party based on local organizations and dues-paying members, and we represented ourselves in the state and national bodies in proportion to the membership. And then some of the parties got ballot lines and they said, oh, we got all these registered voters and we get all these votes in elections, so we deserve more representation than our paid membership. And that argument won out. And so we structured ourselves like the Democrats and Republicans. And what that did was basically defund the party, so we don't have paid staff and field organizers to expand the party. And we don't have real accountability, because with that structure, you have an atomized base of voters, but they're not organized to get their interests together and expressed in the party structure. So we have not been good nationally about building a real organization that is capable not just of running good elections, but of being involved in the social movements that an electoral success has to come out of. So we've got to do a lot in terms of restructuring ourselves. And that's been a problem for the left really since the Socialist Party collapsed finally, you know, after the 1932 election. That party was a membership-based party and had significant influence and votes from around 1900 to 1932. I think that's the model we got to look at to see how we can grow and build our influence. I would also say that we've been in a conservative period where both parties keep moving to the right, and the corporate control of the media and economic policy, I mean, everything has moved to the right. It's been a tough period in which to build a left. But I think things are changing. Now socialism is a term of discussion rather than a word that just stops discussion. So things may be opening up, and it's incumbent upon us to get well organized so we can take advantage of that situation.
If you get the nomination, the Green Party's presidential nomination this time around, how will your campaign be different than the Green Party in 2016?
We're going to put our resources mainly into building the Green Party. That means starting this year, and this is leading up to the nomination, we help state parties get on the ballot. We have 20 state parties that have the ballot, but we need 31 more states to get on the ballot for the 2016 election. And that's a massive job. It's about 800,000 signatures and at least 1.5 million just to have some coordinators and staff to help the volunteers get all those signatures. So with the ballot line, and you get the ballot line, then you have it for a few years, we can run a lot more local candidates where we do often win races, and we build this thing from the bottom up. Once we have the nomination in the ballot lines, we want to put field organizers out there that can help Green Party locals learn how to organize. Green Party members are very reliable activists. They show up. They do things. But they're not well educated in organizing, the kind of things a union organizer or a community organizer knows. How do you go out and talk to people that are not part of what you're doing already? And how do you work with them? How do you build trust with them? And, you know, there are a lot of techniques in organizing that the Greens are not well schooled in. And I think what we want to do is help them do that during the course of the campaign so we're prepared going into the 2020s to really make a difference.
And now the Democrats are putting more barriers in the way of the Green Party with their H.R. 1.
Yeah, that's a omnibus bill that has a lot of good stuff in it, but there's some things related to getting matching funds for presidential elections. They're basically increasing fivefold the amount of money that a candidate needs to raise in order to qualify for the matching funds. And then the 5% threshold you mentioned, the way it's been since Watergate is you reach that 5% threshold, and then in the fall election, you get a public grant to run your campaign. Now, the two major parties are so flush with money from the rich folks that they've declined that. Obama did it in 2008. McCain couldn't afford to, but 2012 and 2016, both parties said, we don't need your public money because we can raise a lot more from corporate America. But for a minor party, that would be significant. What this bill does is end that program and basically says, if you qualified for public funding in the primary season with matching funds, you can continue to get matching funds in the fall election, which is a different system. And because the matching funds are harder to qualify, you may not get any of that in the fall election. So it is making it more difficult for an upstart party like the Greens to get the public funding that the system has made available to some extent since Watergate.
More and more, it appears that the Democratic Party can not accommodate both its dominant corporate Democrats and its leftish elements. How many Democrats really ought to be Greens?
Well, I think the people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would be a lot more comfortable with us than within the Democratic Party. And hopefully she's finding that out and realizing that you're not going to get what you want through the Democratic Party. You know, what the Greens have to do is get better organized so that we look like a viable place to go to. Because there is a contradiction between the progressive Democrats and the corporate Democrats, no doubt about that. And even more important than the politicians is the base. You know, there was a whole movement when Sanders did not get the nomination, and we found out that DNC colluded with Clinton to make sure that didn't happen. And a lot of people were looking for an alternative. Now, some came to the Greens. Others looked at us and said, well, you're not strong enough either. And the way we can take advantage of that contradiction is to be ready when people are ready to leave the Democratic Party. So that's what I hope to do with this campaign.
That was Howie Hawkins, who's exploring whether to run for president under the Green Party banner. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held its third electoral political school in St. Petersburg, Florida, earlier this month. Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela greeted the participants.
What is an election in an imperialist country and a so-called bourgeois democracy? It is a non-violent contest between sectors, contending sectors of the bourgeoisie for control of the state. That's all it is. It's not there to make revolution. It's to make sure revolution doesn't happen. It's the thing that exists in order for the bourgeoisie to have these nonviolent fights among themselves for controlling this apparatus, the controlling the world, you see. Otherwise, if they didn't have this, they'd be acting like other places around the world where people have these differences, warlords and stuff, fighting each other to get the stuff. They don't have to fight each other. They go to have an election. And let stuff get too crazy, and then they assassinate a Kennedy, or they overthrow a Nixon, or they do other kinds of stuff when it gets out of hand. If the crisis deepens enough, they do this. But generally speaking, it's a nonviolent contest. And then you have this last election with Trump. Took everything out of kilter because Trump didn't come the way the rest of them came. All of them had patrons. You can see the extent of the split in the bourgeoisie among the ruling class by the number of candidates. The number of candidates represent different capitalist interests vying for control of the state. You had 17 from the Republican Party alone. You had something like 5 or more from the Democratic Party, all of them fighting to become the president. All of them representing specific capitalist contending forces. All of them united with capitalism, but they got their own way and their own interest that they want to pursue nonviolently. And then here's Trump. And Trump, you know, he was so exposing. And in fact, Trump would be on the so-called debating schedule and it would say things like that you can't trust them, all of them. They do what the people who paid him tell them to do. Say, I know because I used to pay him. Y'all remember Trump saying that? And it was true. He was saying they represent different sectors of the bourgeoisie. And Trump was independent up to that point in terms of not having to rely on any of these other forces, not any of the blocks that they had created for pursuit of power. Almost every presidential candidate you see, the campaign manager represents some lobbying group, some lobbying entity. So here's Trump out there by himself. None of the arrangements that's been placed, he doesn't care about them. And the thing is that Trump could go for broke, and he did go for broke. And he busted up. He attacked what? The Atlanticist arrangement. NATO, the United Nations, a whole bunch of other arrangements that had been put in place. Trump was the change in them. He was attacking all of this arrangement. And they all went crazy. It wasn't just the Democrats, but all of them, the Republicans, all of them went crazy. What's this guy doing, right? And I thought they were going to kill Trump. And that's why I said Trump will never be president because they'll kill him. And I think they would have killed him, except they made a mistake of treating him like a buffoon. And when they treat him like a buffoon, he won all these white people. Then to kill him would create all kinds of contradictions with all these white people who are not following Trump, because it would have been clear that they bumped him off. So anyway, he corralled this. And I just want to say that while Trump busted up the Atlanticist group, it's not that he was the only anti-Atlanticist that were there. There were other forces in the bourgeoisie who were opposed to this arrangement. And Trump just made it manifest. And then you have this huge contradiction, and they don't know how to get out of it. You got groups in Spain who are trying to split. You've got much of the whole Europe in a state of crisis and the whole imperialist world. So I just think that we should be aware of this. And finally, that sometimes you have a situation in history where history is condensed in a certain way, and that what used to take 20, 30, 40, 50 years to occur happened in a period of weeks and months. And I think we're at a place like that now, and that we can really make a mistake if we think that the people are today where they used to be just a couple of weeks ago. If they're electing in Chicago, regardless of what you think about her politics, openly gay black woman as the first mayor, something is happening here. Just look at how the politic is acting throughout this country and much of the world today. Clearly, something is happening, and we'd make a mistake if we think that we could just going along with this old Uncle Tom stuff that we were doing just a few months ago, a few years ago, is going to win anything. It's not going to win a damn thing. That we have to be out in front. The people want revolution. The people want reparations. The people want real socialism and not a job under Bernie Sanders' standards. Uhuru.
O'Malley Yeshitela. Nellie Bailey is with Harlem Fight Back Against War at Home and Abroad. She told the Black Is Back Coalition Electoral School that U.S. imperialism's arsenal of war includes the weaponization of the U.S. dollar.
If you have weaponized that dollar, then you can impose sanctions for how much you want on anybody that you want to. That's what you have the power to do. And when Saddam Hussein decided that he was going to accept euro as payments for their oil, he was gone. He was gone. And the shock and awe was to such an extent, and the brutality of it was to send a warning to anybody else who wanted to switch from the petrodollar. They destroyed the country so that they would have contracts to rebuild the country, which is what they did in Libya. Because in Libya, Muammar Gaddafi wanted to establish a central bank, and he wanted to sell his oil, not in petrodollars, but he was looking at the euro. And we saw what happened to him and the brutality of that. These are the monsters that we're dealing with. China, they are now trading their oil or goods in Chinese currency. The next economic meltdown, which is coming soon, which will necessitate another bank bailout to the tune of trillions of dollars. So in the meantime, the Chinese infrastructure bank, they aren't going to be accepting dollars. They already have an endless supply of dollars. No, the world is changing. The world is changing. The sanctions against Russia, it's not working because people are seeking an alternative to the weaponized dollar, and they are slowly but surely begin to see the success of that strategy because the failure of the weaponized U.S. dollar is inevitable. It's going to happen, and we need to talk about it. We need to talk about it among ourselves. And when we talk about financial literacy, let's understand the losing power of the dollar and how we use it here in this economy.
Veteran Harlem activist and also my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Ajamu Baraka is a former Green Party vice presidential candidate and now lead organizer at the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka was in Venezuela when it was plunged into darkness last month by a suspected U.S. cyber weapons attack. He says the black and brown populations of that country support the socialist government.
We had a chance to meet with many, many communities. Of course, we got a chance to link up with our folks, Brother Chucho Garcia, many of you all might know, who was the ambassador from Venezuela to Angola. He was also here at the Consulate General down in New Orleans. He's the co-founder of the Afro-Venezuela Network. So we had a chance to get into the black communities. We went to a place called Katia. Katia is a community on the side of the mountains in Caracas. 1.5 million people who 20 years ago, according to the white oligarchy, they didn't exist. Why? Because these people are primarily African and other people of color in that country, in that city, in that community. After the revolution occurred, they now exist. They now have water they didn't have before, electric link-ups they didn't have before, sewage systems they didn't have before. And they are now the backbone, the basis of the resistance at this point. They are the ones that when you see those pictures of these massive demonstrations, they come down in the thousands from Katia. They are the basis of the resistance, the basis of the revolution. So when we tell people about Venezuela, and when they hear about some so-called dictatorship, and they got to support the U.S. because they need to provide humanitarian intervention, we say that understand that this war being waged by the U.S. against Venezuela is a war being waged against you, against our people. Understand the realities of what's happening in the world today. So we got a chance to see resistance front and center in Venezuela. We need to link up this issue of Venezuela with this expansion of NATO. Many of you have heard that we had some demos in the last few weeks targeting the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because what we see with NATO is the use of this militarized structure to advance white supremacist domination. It's gone way beyond the North Atlantic, and now they're expanding globally. So one of the nations they brought in as a so-called global partner is Colombia. Now, Colombia is in Latin America. What does Colombia have to do with the North Atlantic? But they brought Colombia in because Colombia is on the border of Venezuela. And you might recall that when this neo-fascist from Brazil met with Trump a week or so ago, Trump talked about bringing in Brazil into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So it shows the true nature of this structure, that these folks are all about attempting to maintain global white supremacy. Okay? And we need to be clear about that and clear about that with our folks. We've got to make the link. You got to make the link between what's happening in Venezuela and globally and what is happening here. The kind of militarism and targeting of these nations that find themselves in the crosshairs of U.S. imperialism is the flip side of the war being waged against our people here in this country. So we have to talk about the Department of Defense 1033 program, the program responsible for militarizing police forces here in this country. We got to talk about the deadly exchange, this training of U.S. police forces by the Israeli government. Chicago, Atlanta, even in St. Louis, they all over. And in these cities that are controlled by, theoretically, by black folks. We got to talk about, you know, why we have to have community control of the police. We got to remind our people of the continuation of mass incarceration. We've got to make these connections and make these connections so that they are part of the national discourse in this bourgeois electoral process.
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace.
This weekend, anti-mass black incarceration activists in South Carolina commemorated the deaths of at least 7 inmates during disturbances at the Lee County State Prison a year ago. Ifeo Wangaza is director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina, and a key link between prison inmates and their supporters on the outside.
The Free South Carolina movement memorialized the first anniversary of the South Carolina Department of Corrections orchestrated Lee County tragedy, where at least 7, and by some reports from the inside, as many as 12 people died. Over 20 people were injured, and thousands throughout the system were traumatized. Our goal was to call attention to the fact that not only did folks lose their lives, folks were injured, and folks were traumatized, but that the state's responsibility in these losses has not been acknowledged. And not only has it not been acknowledged, but that the wrongs have not been corrected and the persons injured receive the care and support that they're entitled to. In fact, the state's response has been to further criminalize the persons in their custody and to techno-militarize the facilities in which they are held, with spending $19 million to put up golf netting, cell phone jamming, raising the salaries of guards without fully funding education and rehabilitative programs, without, as ordered by the federal courts, to fully staff and provide mental health services. Indeed, they have held the majority of our brothers and sisters in 23-hour lockdown throughout the state, allowing people to have showers only once a week or once every other week, depending on the sentiment of the wardens and keepers in charge. So our focus was to call attention to this continuing situation, in addition to calling the names of the seven who died, who by record died at Lee County, and those who have died since that time. We also call the name of the one woman who is acknowledged to have died over the past 12 months since April 15, 2018, and her name is Desiree Algram.
You were speaking of the Free South Carolina movement. Those members of that movement couldn't participate in the event because the Free South Carolina movement is made up of inmates imprisoned in the system.
That's correct. However, we do make it a point to use the technology to include them, and that inclusion, of course, ranges from their being able to observe the activities that are going on in their name. They issue official statements, which was read at Saturday's event, and in past years, they have been able to actually call in and to speak directly to the audience. That was not the case on Saturday, but normally we do attempt to allow them to actually articulate in person in their own voice. We don't view them as being voiceless people. We are simply extensions of their voice.
The events of last year inside the prison in Lee County are universally described by the corporate media as a prison riot, but you say the responsibility is with the state.
Absolutely. The state controls every aspect of their lives, from their waking up in the morning until the time, at least in theory, that they go to bed at night. The state controls their diet. The state controls their near non-existent access to medical care. The state controls their non-existent access to education and vocational skill development. State imposes on folk throughout the prison system in South Carolina, as is the case throughout this country, what information they have access to, with the exception of those who have limited access through the use of cell phones, which is, of course, the reason why the state wants to get rid of the cell phones. But beyond that, and that's a very small number of people. You know, we're talking about, in South Carolina, we're talking about 17,000 people in custody, with some minimal number of percentage of those people having cell phones or access to cell phones. So whatever activities, like a computer, you know, what goes in is what comes out, is the result of what the state has made available to them or denied them. And Lee County is a specific reflection of that. Lee County was orchestrated in that. Leading up to Lee County, the state banned all Rastafarian volunteer support. It secondly scattered all of the Rastafarian leadership. And thirdly, it concentrated in one dormitory all of the brothers known to have disagreements among themselves. It's important to note the Rastafarian community because it is known throughout the prison system in this country as being violence interveners and mediators. And so the state got rid of the mediators in order to set into force the results that occurred at Lee County and continues to occur throughout the prison systems in this country. and in South Carolina in particular. As the Free South Carolina Movement pointed out, if the state was as vigilant about finding weapons as it is about finding cell phones, a lot less harm would come to inmates in, that they are responsible for.
Is it possible in the South Carolina prison system for inmates to protest the conditions or even express themselves in any meaningful way non-violently?
Yes, it's possible. And in fact, brothers and sisters do engage in non-violent protest activities. Today, April 15th, the actual date, anniversary date, prisoners throughout the South Carolina Department of Corrections will fast from sunup to sundown and have political discussion and physical exercise to memorialize those who died at Lee County and since over the past 12 months. The fasting will include refusal to take food from the dining hall and to use the canteen. So there are opportunities to resist in ways that are nonviolent, and indeed they are inviting others throughout the country to join with them in this form of memorialization and protest. In fact, the last call for a strike was purportedly in the name of Lee County. So we asked those who made that call to join in this effort to remember Lee County, to sanctify and affirm the humanity of the folks in whose name they claim to have acted last year.
We read that all the South Carolina legislature has managed to do in the year since the events in Lee County is to provide money for more locks in the prison.
That's exactly what they've done. They have further criminalized the brothers and sisters in their custody and spent up to $19 million in techno-militarization of the facilities throughout the state, ranging from installing 50-foot golf netting around the facilities, purportedly to prevent folks throwing cell phones over the fence. They've invested in drone repelling equipment. They've subscribed to cell phone jamming equipment. They've raised the salaries of guards. In the meantime, they have refused to hire and provide the mental health services that they have been ordered by federal court order to provide. They have not fully funded the educational programs nor vocational training programs, nor have they funded the drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs. They put up some window dressing programs, one that they're doing in conjunction with the Vera Institute, where they have about 10 or 12 folk involved in that, and they're about to start a second one of those, but even the combination of the two is not 50 people out of 17,000, so we can see what a sham that is. They're supposed to be experimenting with using European models for rehabilitation as opposed to simply doing those things that affirm the humanity and dignity of the persons in their charge and preparing them to return to our various communities with the necessary emotional and physical and intellectual well-being that rehabilitation and appropriate medical care and nutrition would assure.
You've been an anti-mass incarceration activist for a long time. How does South Carolina's prison system rank among the others?
I think that the fact that South Carolina takes pride in spending the least amount of money, about 14 cents a meal, on prisoners' meals says exactly where it ranks, and that is at the very bottom. If people are not eating a proper diet, which is the cornerstone of all else, then there is no expectation that those persons are going to be able to function to a minimal capacity, not to mention their full human potential. There are some instances, mental health ratios of one counselor to 1,500 prisoners. So the South Carolina Department of Corrections, as they call themselves, is designed to be a self-perpetuating machine.
And of course, the activists are most concerned that the public not forget those who died a year ago.
Absolutely. It is in affirming their dignity and worth that we affirm our own dignity and worth. And we do that best by calling their names, because as long as we call their names, they are not only not forgotten, but they continue to live. In Lee County, there was Raymond Angelo Scott, Michael Millage, DeMonte Rivera, Eddie Gaskins, Joshua Jenkins, Corey Scott, Cornelius McClary, and given the failure, continuing failure of the South Carolina Department of Corrections and the annual increase in the number of people dying in their custody, we add Adam Orr, Derek Futrick, Mr. H. Simmons, Alan Jerome Capers, and Desiree Algren. We say their names, we memorialize them, and we protest the continued human rights abuses of the South Carolina Department of Corrections.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation. We'll be right back.